Thank you very much, Carl. And please let me, can everybody hear me okay? Good, good. Start squawking yourself if I'll just notice sounds if somehow my internet becomes unstable. So great to see everybody. And just to start off with, just curious, and there's no need, but did anybody have any reaction or reflection or questions or comments about the guided meditation that I did at the beginning and then at the end? And no need, but just wanted to see.
I was surprised when you started talking and giving instruction how so many other things I was thinking about. Like, I'm not usually aware of the that, you know.
All the
And
mental
you'd start to
activity.
say something, and I was like, oh, yeah, I'm meditating now, you know.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. The mental activity is that's the big one. That's why I
Yeah.
saved that for the last invitation to be effortlessly aware of. Yeah. Thanks, Deborah. So that anybody else have anything they want to note? Some of the that meditation was actually from that I adapted it from a 7th century Chinese Zen master named Hongren. And so that image of awareness always fluctuating and moving, like a flowing river or like flowing water, is I think what he says, and then a mirage. And then dissolving when you're just with the awareness, when you can be that stable in meditation practice. Not always available, certainly for me, not always available, but when you can get down to that flow of just the changing awareness, that it can dissolve into this peaceful stability. And then Hongren at the very end says, which will then at some point disappear like a gust of wind. So it's this, just cleansing of the mind to the state of being. And it reminds me too that this state of being is something that often can be aspirational for me, but also in meditation, note when I'm moving toward that sense of quiet or stability, even though it's not to this, level of it. A gust of wind just whisping it all away. That this is also really beneficial to us in our meditation. So it also, I thought so interestingly, the way Hongren describes this in the 7th century China setting high atop a mountain, it also is similar to the Theravadin approach from the earliest writings and accounts of the Buddha back in India. Much longer before that. And Alan mentioned it last week, describing to us the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the lengthy and famous sutta about the last days of the Buddha. The mythological lord of the Devas named Sakka at that moment, he sort of says a similar thing. He declares just as the Buddha is transitioning from life to death, that he says, all creations, all fabrications, the things we come up with in our minds, all these created things in our hearts and minds are ephemeral in their nature. They're unsatisfactory. They constantly change. And their very nature is to arise and pass away. Just like Hongren was talking about, arise and pass away. Their very nature is they're starting to dissemble as soon as they appear. And then, when all those things still, when that gust of wind sort of takes them all away, then arises this blissful quiet, this blissful quiet that's peace. And again, it doesn't always just magically happen that way when we sit down to meditation. But I think part of the crux of this is that it is so powerful, just as Deborah was talking about all those thoughts going on in our minds that we're not aware of so often. These thoughts are so powerful, and our minds can add associative thinking, opinions, judgments, interpretations, to nearly any experience that comes in, from a sound to a smell to another thought to just nearly anything. And what the Dharma is pointing to is that these are subjective. Our thoughts and interpretations, they're subjective. Sometimes they have some connection to objective reality and need to be acted upon. But so often they're subjective and create a false reality, a false interpretation of what's going on. And in this meditation practice, both, well, especially actually in Vipassana meditation in the Theravada, once we sit and quiet our minds and then can notice this constant changing nature of our consciousness, then we can connect to this peace. And so then another aspect that I draw is something else that I relied on in sort of thinking about this meditation was a 17th century Japanese Zen monk named Bankei. And Bankei and I think many Zen monks from Japan, they would call this state of peaceful stability, this bliss, this original state of bliss, they would call it the unborn Buddha mind, the Buddha mind that actually we all possess, the Buddha nature. And not in some metaphysical way, but in an experiential way. Not, you know, trying to debate the essence of life and that sort of thing, but in a very experiential way, that underneath all the noise, there is this original Buddha nature. And this is the way Bankei put it. Bankei is an interesting monk. He was a Rinzai Zen monk, and he was a populist monk. He held Dharma talks both to the other monastics that were, you know, practicing in the temples, but also to all sorts of householders, lay people that came. So this is what he describes in a really active way. He says, the inherited Buddha mind is beyond any doubt unborn, with a marvelously bright, illuminative wisdom. So while you're facing me, he's addressing the people there in attendance back 400 years ago, while you're facing me, listening to me speak, say a crow cawed or a sparrow chirped, you would have no difficulty hearing it and knowing that's a sparrow or that's a crow, and receiving that directly, receiving that unmitigated and directly. And what Bankei says, that's living in this unborn Buddha mind, because you're listening directly. We actually have some crows that are nesting in our backyard area. And so I can really notice the difference between the sound of a crow and then all my discursive thinking about it. Are they nesting in my gutter? Why won't they quiet down a little bit? You know, all that sort of stuff. But that's my created story. That's extra. And that's what Bankei says too. When you're listening in the unborn, each and every sound is heard as it occurs. No one who lives in the unborn is concerned with self or other. They're beyond them. They're beyond them both. But when a thought appears, we've already fallen just slightly removed from that reality of direct experience in the unborn. So again, I really like how Bankei puts that there is this unborn. And he likes to say, he says over and over in his Dharma talks, not a single one of you here at this talk tonight or this afternoon, whenever it was, Japan. Not a single one of you is unenlightened. Right now, you're all sitting here before me as Buddhas. Because within us is this unborn Buddha mind that we might not always realize and partake of, but it's there. It's there. And I really like the thought too, that what we do on Monday nights here is that we do take a break for an hour together or a few minutes more or less. And in our own way, we're touching in to that unborn Buddha mind and sort of, if you will, honoring the Buddha mind in all of us. And a time when we'll be quiet together, we'll try to direct our energies to things that are positive, useful, that create peace and skill in the world. And it's a break. It's a time we can act kindly with toward each other, speak with care, listen with care. It's a great refuge. And that's why I liked the idea of coming home to the present moment, coming home to hours like this, our hours, that we're a refuge in our Buddha mind. So as Zen monks are wont to do, Bankei could be a little bit provocative as well. And he was not about to let his students off easy, sort of lulling them into, yes, the beauty of the Buddha mind. I hope everybody heard that little sound as I knocked something off the table here. Just noting sound effortlessly, the in-breath and the out-breath. So he's just assured everybody that everybody is a sitting Buddha. And then he says, nonetheless, when you get up and begin to file out of this hall, you might bump into somebody in front of you, or somebody behind you might run into you and accidentally bump you over. So, or when you go home, your husband, I guess there were a lot of women at this because he just says husband, son, daughter-in-law, and I'll say he throws in a servant. So there's a little class stuff going on there, or anybody else. They might say something that displeases you. And if something like that happens, are you going to grasp onto it and begin to fret over it, sending blood to your head, raising up your horns, and falling into the illusion of self-partiality? It's all about me. The Buddha mind then turns willy-nilly into a fighting spirit. By getting upset and favoring yourself, you fall into a deluded existence of your own making. And so I think he's talking about the same thing. When we apply our thoughts and interpretations and judgments, opinions that are, we think they're so real, but they're subjective, we create our own realities, which he calls deluded existence. Because other people don't share the same view of reality. And something that Bankei does, and I'm going to give you a couple other examples to get the flavor of what he does. He's talking about it always, the examples he gives in these talks, it's about interpersonal relationships. And I think that's really where the rubber can hit the road in our Dharma practice, right? It's easy enough to, when we sit in quiet, well, it's hard enough, right, to sit in quiet, but we process our own issues. But then once we interact with another person, often that's when a lot of the stuff really comes up. So let me give you another example, because I think I like how vivid some of them are. This is an example. He says, in the houses with domestic help, servant boys and girls are employed in large numbers. Some among them are bound to be careless with things. Occasionally treasured dishes and other articles are broken. Perhaps it's something not even worth mentioning, but in any case, you let the blood rush to your head, you lash out and you scold the offender angrily. But no matter how prized the dish or tea bowl may have been, it wasn't broken deliberately. It was an accident and there was nothing that could have been done. But just the same, you fly into rage and let the defilements of your self-centered passions transform your precious Buddha mind. You've transformed your precious Buddha mind into a fighting spirit. And he adds, you can always buy another teacup Tea tastes the same, regardless of whether it's drunk from an ordinary teacup or a priceless Korean tea bowl. You can drink it just as well from both. But a temper, once lost, can't easily be reclaimed. And the precious Buddha mind, once that's lost, that's a lot more difficult than just going to the store and buying a cup. We condition it over and over. So he's being very, very cautionary here, cautionary. And the last one, he describes quarreling. And he says, if the people sitting next to you start quarreling, it may be easy for you to tell which of the people is right and which of them is wrong, because you're not involved. You're a bystander, so you can keep a cool head. But what if you do take a part in it? Take one side and oppose the other. You lose your temper, become contentious, and then you think, I haven't lost my temper. That fellow won't listen to me. By being so unreasonable, he has made me lose it. So you fix belligerently on his words, and by stewing over and over and churning them over and over in your mind, you might get your way. But what you have done is turn your Buddha mind into an inwardly first-class animal. So vivid, provocative, don't do this. Don't do this. Savor your Buddha mind. It's precious. And though, you know, some of the examples he gave, you know, that was in 17th century Japan, and they might not apply directly to us. But when I read those, I thought, wow, that's pretty relevant to me. There's some more that he gave. I won't share them all. But I could see myself doing that. I've been in an argument or two of myself. I don't know about you. And know how I can get attached to points of view. Is everybody hearing me still? I think, raise a hand if you could. Good. Okay. So, he offers just a little bit about sort of how to come back. And again, saying that that it's vitally important not to lose that Buddha mind. And then he points to, this is classic Buddhism. He points to the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. And he says, Just pay attention, be aware of how these notions of greed, you know, especially greed for ourselves, how that takes something that we can first receive as neutral and then transform it into something that gets our minds all turned up and causes us to become those fighting spirits, or hatred or dislike or fear when we don't like what's going on, that too can do that. Or when we just are not paying attention, when we're just not aware of the impact our actions or words might have on others, when we're being thoughtless, that too can create the sort of division and discord that then churns again in our minds. And something Bankei has is, it's very much connected to many different forms of Buddhism, but Bankei notes how our own subjective interpretation of events, how then our conditioned interpretation then influences how we interact with other people. And then how we interact with other people, that turns up the volume. It creates a whole new dynamic, which then feeds back into how we perceive the world. So it comes back into our internal mind. This dynamic can be really, really powerful. So it's sort of interesting to me. Wasn't it kind of nice in the beginning of this talk? We were talking about the Buddha mind, that we all have Buddha mind, and this beautiful aspiration of the peaceful stability, the bliss of silence. And sort of talking of all this, you know, I feel like I sort of want to take a bath. it's ugly a little bit. So again, that's another inspiration. What do I want my mind and my life to be about? You know, and what an invitation Dharma and Buddhism offers us for what our minds and our lives can be about, our hearts. So this is the final thing that Bankei ended that particular Dharma talk with. And I really like it. And this is what he says is, I always urge people simply to live in that unborn Buddha mind. Just be at home in the Buddha mind. Not strain into illusion, not seeking enlightenment beyond that. I really like that too. Not seeking enlightenment beyond your own experience, your own mind, your own heart. And he says, just sit in the Buddha mind, stand in the Buddha mind, sleep in the Buddha mind, awaken in the Buddha mind, do everything in the Buddha mind. Then you'll be functioning as a living Buddha in all that you do in daily life. And there's nothing further. So there's nothing further, no grand further conclusion, no great enlightenment other than being in the Buddha mind every moment, right here, right now, looking at the Zoom screen at each other, present with an in-breath, an out-breath, sights, the sounds, smells, the tastes, the thoughts, always moving like a flowing stream or mirage in the desert, dissolving into peaceful stability together here and now. So thank you all for listening and being here and sharing the Buddha mind together. An in-breath and an out-breath. Buddha mind, Buddha breath, and everything. We even have a couple moments maybe before we have to wrap up. If anybody has something they want to share, either thoughts about the Buddha mind or peace, or maybe when we click off that Zoom for this meeting later this evening and somebody metaphorically bumped into you, how you respond and how you come back home. Come back home. So please, if anybody wants to share something. Loki?
Just a thought that when we fall into a reaction, one of the classic three poisons or whatever, that we can add on to that with recrimination rather than just seeing it as another mind object. And there are times to harness that, you know, if you're going to be dealing with social injustice. So that brings up, you know, how do we abide in that unborn Buddha mind, which I just love that unborn. It's like the deathless, another term, the deathless, you know, and still be compassionately activist if we need to be, which sometimes, well, our times call for it with all that's happening externally. So we can add on to that. It's like, yeah. Oh, there I go again, getting pissed off. And then you get mad at yourself for getting mad or whatever.
Yeah, and I think actually, Loki, you're calling to attention something that I wanted to mention too, that I think we need to use with a great care, that we're in the year 2022, and right now the people on this call are on the North American continent, I think. and so like this talk and many of the teachings, these were written like the suttas, the original suttas, I think, was it the Bronze Age? They were written, you know, they came from teachings 2,500 years ago in a different culture. And then I quoted, you know, a meditation instruction from 7th century China from a mountaintop, and then Tokugawa Japan. And there are many different cultural overlays, societal values. So I just think of one, you know, I would not say I'm an expert on Japanese attitudes, but something I do know is that showing public anger is something that's not so valued. So I don't know if some of Bankei's talking about how he responds to losing your temper, maybe that has a cultural aspect to it too. That either way, and I think this is something we talked about last week, we have to receive that and make it work right here, right now in our society. And what I firmly believe, and from my activist experience, the more I can be in some closer version to the Buddha mind when there's a difficult struggle with things that are really painful and challenging, the more I can have that clarity of mind and clarity of heart, then the extra thoughts then don't interrupt me or don't interfere with my ability to be the strongest advocate, to give the message that's appropriate right then and right now to try to make change for the betterment of everybody. So it's very dynamic. And I think it's core to being effective and dynamic activism. And also, I think just one last thing too, receiving, understanding the cultural context. You know, Zen monks nearly 400 years ago, they spoke differently. And I think it's important, you know, when we see some of this verbiage that I offered where he's sort of cantankerous, you know, don't do this, don't, that doesn't tend to be so effective when we do that to each other. And so you don't see Dharma teachers in America sort of being quite that way. So what you're saying, adding recriminations, that doesn't help, right? That's just adding extra. And so we don't want to receive some of these very strong commands, you know, don't waste your Buddha spirit. Don't become a horned animal. We don't then do the guilt trip on us. Look how bad we are. Look how bad we are. So,
John, great. Thank you. Thank you so much for that beautiful Dharma talk. Let's sit together for 1 minute or so as we dedicate the merit and close tonight. So let's sit. So may the merit of our practice together tonight here in Sangha and listening to the Dharma, may it be for the benefit of all of us, and may that benefit spread to all beings everywhere. May we all and all beings be safe and free from danger and from harm. And may each of us and all beings be healthy in our bodies and our minds. And may we all and all beings be happy and have the causes of happiness in our lives. And may all beings everywhere, excluding none, live with ease and well-being. And ultimately, may we all and all beings everywhere be free. John, thank you again, and thank you all for being here tonight. We're a totally self-organized, self-supporting little sangha. As I said earlier, we're starting our third decade together, and it's really only the generosity of everyone who has ever attended or taken part in any of the tasks that keeps us going that really is instrumental in keeping us alive and thriving, and really keeping these teachings alive for now 2,600 years. And so when we meet in person, we have two baskets, Donna baskets, one for the Sangha and one for the teacher. John graciously has said that any donation that would go to him as being our teacher, our speaker tonight, should go to the Sangha. And you can donate to our Sangha just by going onto our website that Deborah has now posted in the chat. It's just sflgbtsangha.org. There's a little join online button, and on that page, you'll see a place to donate through PayPal. So please be as generous as you can. As you know, we have really not met in person at the San Francisco Buddhist Center where we had been meeting since the start of the pandemic, except for our one time for our 20th anniversary day long last month. But we've continued to pay our rent there just to support them during these difficult times. So be as generous as you can. It's be appreciated, certainly. We're here every Monday, 5:30 to 6:30. That's not a federal holiday. So look forward to seeing you all next week. Pass the word or forward our website to people who you think might be interested, because we're a very open group and would love to have anybody join us. If anybody has any announcements of interest to the group or something coming up, please say something. David.
Yeah, if I might, it's really lovely to be so welcome in this group. I belong to Queer Dharma in Chicago that's hosted by Shambhala Chicago. We meet on Sundays at 6:00. And there is our Zoom link if you'd ever like to visit us. So if you need to sit on a Sunday, feel free. Just wanted to open the invitation to anybody. But thank you very much. And it's very fascinating too, because the way you work is a little different than the way we hold our sessions. So I've been checking out different groups just to get the flexibility of the practice for myself. So great. Love to see you sometime. Thank you.
Thank you, David. And so we'll leave the room open. Let me take the recording off. I gotta figure that out again.